This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Cedarside.com, your all-natural, organic solution to pest control problems, protecting people, pets, and premises. Cedarside.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today's guest is someone who you're very likely to know. He's been a frequent guest on Intelligent Medicine and also on its predecessor program, Health Talk, over the years. He is the author of the best-selling book, Grain Brain, and he now has a new book to tell us all about. Dr. David Perlmutter is a neurologist. He's board certified and one of America's leading integrative neurologists. He serves on the medical advisory board of the Dr. Oz Show, and his book has really gone through the roof. It was a number one New York Times bestseller, and he is also an active practitioner, in addition to lecturing all over the country and all over the world. He practices in Naples, Florida, at an extraordinary center where patients come from all over the world to address neurologically related problems. So welcome back to the program, David. It's nice having you on Intelligent Medicine once again on the occasion of the launch of your new book. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be on any program that has the word intelligent in it. I'll tell you that much.
Okay. Well, are you suggesting that some of the programs that you've been on in the past few months?
I'm not suggesting that in the least. I'm simply saying I'm delighted to be on a show.
No, but you've been everywhere in the media, and maybe some of the shows have been some sort of coffee klatch, morning network shows, with a lot of ladies sitting around.
Some have. Yep. That's for sure. Some have, but hey, I'm any opportunity I get to get the message out, I'm happy to do that. Believe me.
Exactly. So obviously, your book has had a huge impact. It has soared to the top of the charts. I mean, who'd have thunk it? It's a book about nutrition, and yet you managed to pull off a real coup. Congratulations, by creating a book, a vehicle for some really profound ideas and explaining them in a way that really grabbed the attention of the American public. Just great job.
Well, thank you. And, here we are coming up to the one-year mark of being on the New York Times bestseller list every week, and now we're in 27 countries with this book. And on various levels, it has been quite an experience. It's very, very validating when the public response to a person's message is the way this response has been. But it also tells me that I think people have been really desperate to learn information about the role of modifiable lifestyle factors in terms of their brain health. And that's a topic I think no one's really touched upon before, and I think that might explain why the response to Grain Brain has been so overwhelming. Because as a matter of fact, the brain is far more sensitive to these choices that we make than probably any other part of the body. And I don't know why it is, but no one has ever really wanted to talk about that in the past. So we broke the ice, and now it's on the table, and we're talking about, you mentioned carbohydrates and food and exercise, sleep, stress, etc. All these factors are modifiable choices. They are choices that we make every single day. And here's the big news. They play a dramatic role in determining the health destiny of your brain. And frankly, with many of the things that we deal with every day in the clinic, there are no pharmaceutical fixes. There's nothing you can take for your memory. There's no pill for Alzheimer's disease, and yet this is a disease affecting 5.4 million Americans, and as we just recently learned from the RAND Corporation in a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine, we're paying more than $200 billion each year to care for Alzheimer's patients. So, yet, it is a preventable situation, and I think, we live in a generation where kids are really fearful seeing what's happening to their parents, and they're starting to take notice and making these changes.
Well, you know, I think there's a confluence of several events, David. You know, one is this, as you mentioned, an unprecedented crisis because we're really headed off the cliff in terms of our healthcare costs if virtually 60 or 80 million baby boomers reach an age where they're susceptible to dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And there are no plausible cures. We keep coming up with drug fixes that don't pan out. The pharmaceutical industry has actually backed away to some extent from underwriting this very expensive research and approval process. At the same time, there's a greater awareness about gluten sensitivity, which is a major theme of your book. And also, the tide has turned towards a more acceptance of saturated fats and a low-carb diet at the very same time. So I think all these events have shaped the success of your book.
Well, I would agree with you. And, you know, since the last time you and I had a conversation, there has been a variety, really a plethora of very exciting peer-reviewed published studies that have validated exactly what you just said, that we were very much off base in telling people to stop eating saturated fat, and still even further off base in telling people to adopt a low-fat or no-fat diet. And as a matter of fact, nothing could be worse for the human body, for the immune system, and clearly for the brain, which is 60 to 70% fat in the first place. There's more saturated fat in your brain than you can imagine. You know, when we're born, that's the time mostly that we're involved in building a big brain, and human breast milk is 50% saturated fat. So when we're told to restrict consumption of saturated fat, I mean, that means obviously that nature must have gotten it wrong in making breast milk so highly saturated. You know, the beauty of saturated fat, aside from its role in producing healthy cell membranes, is that the more saturated a fat is, the less able that fat is to be damaged or oxidized. So the oxidation or the damage of fat that happens by chemicals called free radicals, it's the reason we take antioxidants, this is happening much less so when a fat is saturated. You cannot oxidize a purely saturated fat by definition. So that when we're telling people now, load up on coconut oil that's more than 95% saturated fat, and the eyebrows go up, they say, well, what are you telling me to do? You know, we're making a health recommendation, looking at coconut oil, for example, that has been validated in peer-reviewed scientific literature going back 3,000 years. Now, I'm not going to tell you that the Vedic texts were actually peer-reviewed and vetted.
Right.
But that said, I mean, you know, there are, in Sanskrit, these citations in the Vedic texts 3,000 years ago talking about increasing the consumption of coconut oil to be beneficial for the brain. And now we see a medical food that you can write a prescription for at the pharmacy to give to your Alzheimer's patients that improves their brain function, their cognitive function, based upon this exact same notion of making fat more available to the brain to use as an energy source in a brain that is no longer particularly suited to utilizing blood sugar or glucose.
As a practical matter, it is now being suggested, of course, by you and others, that people employ coconut oil for dementia and for Alzheimer's disease. Is there a specific amount that might be necessary to achieve the results?
I'm always a little bit reluctant to make specific dosage recommendations in a venue like this, but we usually like to have measurable parameters so we can adjust dosages. Like people say, well, what's the right dosage of vitamin D? And my answer is, I have no idea. I usually start at 5,000 units, but we're following the blood test to titrate the vitamin D dosage until people get to like 70 or 80. Now, when I'm asked the coconut oil question, these days what I'm having my patients do is actually check their urine with a product called Keto Sticks, K-E-T-O-S-T-I-X, which you buy at the pharmacy. They're very inexpensive, and they determine your degree of ketosis. In other words, how well your body is choosing to burn fat as opposed to using carbohydrate as a fuel. So Keto Sticks were used for diabetics, are used for diabetics. They're also used for people trying to lose weight. And now we're employing this very simple, inexpensive home test to really carefully craft a program for individuals in terms of their diets to make sure that they're starting to become ketotic. So that means, getting back to your question, that might mean, in addition to a low-carb diet, one tablespoon of coconut oil a day, or three. I don't know. Let's just get you into ketosis based upon your urine testing at home and adjust these various parameters as we go. And let me say that the idea of keeping people in a low state of ketosis is really my goal in dealing with any neurodegenerative problem, whether it's Parkinson's, multisystem atrophy, progressive supranuclear palsy, Alzheimer's, you name it.
Even ALS, perhaps?
Absolutely ALS, mm-hmm. And I actually wrote a blog about that. What we're doing with the ketosis state is we are speaking to the mitochondria, the energy purveyors of the cell, allowing them to duplicate, to replicate. So there are more mitochondria producing better energy at a cost of less free radical production. So the energy parts of your cells are working more efficiently and producing less exhaust, less damaging free radicals that ultimately damage the cell, damage the very mitochondria that make these free radicals. So the idea of using a ketogenic diet in ALS, in something I've written about, is an extrapolation of the animal data in which, you know, there actually is an ALS animal model that it's a rodent model that gets ALS, and they have almost doubled the lifespan of these laboratory animals by making them ketotic. So I think that as it relates to ALS, we really recognize a couple of things. Number one, that this is, like Parkinson's and like Alzheimer's, a disease predicated on failure of energy production at the level of the mitochondria. The very best we can do is to nurture the mitochondria, and we do that by a low-carbohydrate, higher-fat diet. So, it's great to pour a bucket of water over your head, but at the same time, I think it's really good to look at what the peer-reviewed science is already telling us about that disease and put these things into play today, because as we have this conversation, that disease has no treatment that's effective or even really available.
Well, let's cut to the chase. The new book is entitled The Grain Brain Cookbook, and it's billed as the authorized companion. That's important, the authorized companion, because there's a lot of Me Too books, but this is the authorized companion to the number one New York Times bestseller, Grain Brain. So, you know, so it's not enough to say, look, patients, get in ketosis, cut your carbs. You got to give them some kind of constructive program to follow with food that's palatable and, in fact, delicious, appealing, because this has got to become a lifestyle, not just a 3-week experiment.
So, Ron Hoffman, here we are, a couple of MDs at this stage of our careers, and we're on your program talking about food and a cookbook. I mean, who knew? I mean, did you ever think that's where your career would take you? I mean, I didn't. I mean, in neurology school, we don't spend a lot of time talking about recipes. And yet, here we're back to Hippocrates, let food be thy medicine, let medicine be thy food. And the very food that we choose to consume, yes, has a huge bearing in terms of our health, our longevity, and even the health and functionality of the human brain. So that's what Grain Brain was about. And then, you know, the questions were, okay, so what am I supposed to do for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, for snacks? What do I do if I travel? And that's why we created the Grain Brain Cookbook. And gee whiz, I mean, it's doing really well. People are enjoying the recipes. And how exciting to write a cookbook and to do cooking videos that are on the internet. I mean, who would have thought this would happen at this stage of life?
Where can people see your cooking videos?
They're all over YouTube. They're on our site at drperlmutter.com. And we brought a film crew into our home, actually, and prepared several of the recipes, my wife and I, from...
Because you like to cook, right? I mean, you're into it.
Well, the part of cooking I really like is actually the eating part.
Okay.
I am not the best cook compared to my wife, that's for sure.
Okay.
I love to make omelets, but the truth of the matter is my wife does the cooking. I clean up, and I'm very good at that, and I'm very compulsive about that. But you know, moving forward, our plans are to be in a situation where we will be growing most of our foods and really, you know, expanding what we do in terms of not just the macronutrients of carbohydrates, fat, and protein and the micronutrients, but really looking moving forward at how we cultivate both probiotic foods by fermentation and even really incorporate lots of prebiotic our diet as well, which is what we're already doing. But I think I'm kind of letting the cat out of the bag in terms of where we're going with reference to general health. And, you know, that said, what we're talking about here are the good bacteria that live within us. And to go so far as to say that I'm actually treating various challenging neurological diseases now by paying attention to what is going on in the gut bacteria. Mm-hmm. So we've actually founded a new peer-reviewed medical journal called
Brain and Gut. I forgot to mention that. Yeah, that's amazing.
No problem. And I mean, that's going to debut probably the next month or so. And I mean, here is a medical journal with editors from our most well-respected international universities focused on the relationship of what goes on in the gut and how it influences the brain and, oddly enough, vice versa. So it's a very interesting time for all of us who have, you know, sort of taken our lumps as we became integrative or functional practitioners over the years. And now we're watching the great surge in interest in the population in general that, yeah, you know, these lifestyle choices that I make, as a matter of fact, are hugely important in determining my destiny, and that there aren't really terrific medicines out there to treat these diseases that could have been prevented. That's the message. You know, John Kennedy said the time to fix the roof is when the sun is shining. And I think I've used that, that's been my motto for a number of years, preventive medicine as it relates to the brain.
Do you feel it's important for people not just with diagnosed neurological disorders, but ordinary folks to adopt this type of diet? Or is it necessary? Can they adopt a sort of a modified form of the ketogenic diet?
I would say that this is what everyone needs to do. And I know, you know, we live in a time of one size not fitting all. But I think in general, the biggest health issue from a preventive perspective in Western cultures is our overindulgence in carbohydrates across the board. Mm-hmm. Now, how aggressive a person is, of course, something we would determine based upon whether disease is present or not. But I think, you know, why wait? Why not fix the roof again while the sun is shining?
Right.
And recognize that carbohydrates through insulin increase fat, increase inflammation, increase free radical production. And these are the cornerstones for everything bad you don't want to get, including cancer, inflammatory diseases, autoimmune diseases, brain degenerative conditions, and even coronary artery disease. And it's really quite compelling when research comes out, as it did just a couple of weeks ago, indicating that weight loss.
You're thinking of the Annals of Internal Medicine study that was so highly touted? Yeah, that just came out.
Yep. I mean, you could criticize it for saying that just not being specific in terms of the type of fat, type of protein, and certainly the type of carbohydrate. But I think the core message here is that humans need to eat more good fats, certainly not the trans fats, the modified fats. The omega-6s should be avoided. We'll cover that in a moment. But I think that it made very clear that there is a big risk involved in our overconsumption of carbohydrates. We're watching these rates of obesity climb around the world just since the introduction of refined carbohydrates, and that's, you know, because of their shelf life, their ease of transport. You know, that's becoming the staple around the world, and it's devastating to see what's happening. And I think the mission is to right that wrong, and people can eat what they want, but my mission is to at least tell you what I believe, based upon what I've studied, is the best recommendation, and that is to absolutely do your utmost to get these carbs off your plate. Welcome back healthy fats to the table.
Well, let me dial up this study that we're both talking about. The Archives of Internal Medicine study was widely reported on. I'm looking here at an article in the New York Times by Anahad O'Connor, science and medical correspondent for the Times. And what they said was that after a year-long trial, I think they pitted the low-carb diet versus the low-fat diet. After a year, by the way, this is a heterogeneous group, men and women, and unique in the study is that they were of different races, because previous studies they've said, oh, you know, it's just looking at Hispanics, you can't generalize, or it's looking at white males. This is a mixed group. So by the end of the study, people in the low-carb group had lost about 8 pounds more on average than those in the low-fat group. And to the criticism that, okay, great, they lost weight, but they're going to be skinny corpses, they looked at their cardiovascular risk factors. They found lower inflammation, higher HDL, lower triglycerides, lower LDL, and every suggestion that they would be better off from a cardiovascular standpoint. So that's really a resounding vindication of what you've been talking about in your books.
Exactly. And, you know, this isn't the first time we've seen these studies. I mean, the New England Journal of Medicine published back in July of 2008 an actual interventional trial over 2 years, 322 individuals. And these were people who were placed on similar diets, low carb versus low fat. And across the board, the people eating more fat lost more weight and had dramatic reductions in a variety of really, you know, very important parameters like C-reactive protein, which is a marker of inflammation. The blood sugars, the even blood pressures were improved. Blood pressure improved by eating more fat. So, you know, it's time to rewrite that story quite a bit and recognize that our scientists have not necessarily been giving us the best advice. You know, the cover of Time magazine a couple of months ago was "Eat Butter: Why Our Scientists Were Wrong."
Whereas 20 years ago, it was like a frowny face made with a piece of bacon, and the eyes were two egg yolks.
That's right.
And that was like, you know, 20 years ago, then flash forward to now, and it's the opposite conclusion. So,
well,
you know.
So there are two real traction points. Number one, the traction point of what is the science telling us? And the other traction point is what have we historically eaten for tens of thousands of years? You know, even hundreds of thousands of years, we didn't have carbs. We wouldn't, hunter-gatherers wouldn't stumble upon a wheat field or an apple orchard or find, you know, vineyards. So it wasn't that way. And the genome, our DNA that was so carefully honed over hundreds of thousands of years to allow us to survive to this day, is a genome, is DNA that has never been influenced by exposure to high carbohydrates. So to be very clear, what I'm saying is, yes, the very types of food that we choose to consume influence our genetic expression. And we are now sending signals to our DNA that are perverse and having bad health outcomes because of it.
David, what I'm going to do at this point is I'm going to pause because we divide these podcasts into two parts. So let's stipulate this is part one, and we want our listeners to tune into our part two, where we're going to talk specifics. We'll talk about various conditions. We'll talk about some of the brain nutrients that you think are important. And we'll take a closer look at the new book, The Grain Brain Cookbook, with today's guest, Dr. David Perlmutter. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.